This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to learn more about investing in healthcare and the latest in COVID treatments and vaccines. My guest is Barron's healthcare reporter, Josh Nathan Cases. Josh, it's great to have you back on Barron's Live.
Thanks. Great to be here. Good to talk to you.
All right. We've got a lot to cover today. So let's start with the big picture story on COVID. Suddenly, it's not really looking so good. I have to tell you personally, I'm very glad I didn't go to the White House correspondence dinner. It seems to have led to quite a few infections. I'm glad you didn't go either. But you don't have to go too far today to find a COVID resurgence. It does not seem to want to go away. Tell us what's happening out there.
I mean, things have gotten confusing, at least for me. I mean, you know, cases are up nationwide right now about 50% over the last 2 weeks. You know, you can sort of see, or a number of weeks ago, we talked about how cases were spiking in the Northeast. Seems like cases are still climbing in the Northeast, but, you know, you see a lot of steep climbs in the Midwest. You know, it's, again, hard to know exactly what to make of case increases these days, given that so many people are, you know, testing at home and not reporting those tests. And so those figures notionally or likely would not be reflected. Those tests and those positives would not be reflected in these case increases. You know, more important, I think, are hospitalizations, which are up 18% nationwide over the last 2 weeks. The daily average now is around 17,000. And that, you know, to give you a sense of scale, is roughly a tenth of the late January average of, 160,000. You know, the Delta variant peak was around 100,000. So, you know, we're pretty low. The hospitalizations bottomed out in mid-April at around 15,000 per day. So, you know, relative to where we've been, hospitalizations are in a pretty good place. And deaths also are we should frame it like that, but deaths are at about 350 people dying per day, which is high number, but again, relative to where we've been, that's quite a low number.
So didn't we pass the million mark recently in America?
Yes. Yeah. That's another grim milestone.
Yeah. Extremely. So tell me about the variant landscape. It's so confusing with all these BA numbers.
This is where things have gotten very confusing in the sort of the way that we've been trained to think about it last year in terms of these, you know, Greek lettered variants now out the window because they've decided to go back to these sort of letter number names to identify the various subvariants of Omicron, which now are dominating the world in terms of the sort of genetic makeup of the virus. You know, as I think people probably know by now, the original Omicron variant in the U.S. is basically extinct. But, you know, what people may not have caught on to at this point is that BA2 is no longer overwhelmingly dominant. BA2 is at about 62%. The rest of it in the U.S. Per CDC estimates is a variant called BA2.12.1, and that's the central New York variant. That's about 30-something percent. And it is supposed to be, you know, even more transmissible than BA2. It's also worth mentioning that there are new subvariants of Omicron that are causing a surge in South Africa. These go by the numbers BA4 and BA5. And there have been some reports in the last few days that they can evade protections in the unvaccinated induced by prior infection with BA1, which isn't great. And, you know, as people will remember, there's a long history of waves beginning in South Africa and then moving, you know, to parts of Europe and then into the U.S.
Well, I have to say, no wonder you're confused, but none of these seem to be causing severe disease like the original COVID and Delta. Is that true?
Well, they can certainly cause severe disease, but right, for whatever reason, whether it's something intrinsic about these viruses or the layers of protection, both both from vaccination and natural immunity that exist in global populations. As we can see, you know, rates of severe disease are not what they were by any means.
All right. Well, the whole report is kind of worrisome, Josh, if you ask me. And also worrisome were some recent comments from Moderna's CEO about the company's ability to ready a new vaccine for a new strain that could appear in the fall. You spoke to Stefan Bancel, the CEO of the company. What did he tell you?
Right. So just to take a step back, you know, Moderna has been working on a number of new versions of its COVID vaccine. You know, right now, the COVID vaccine that you can get is the original COVID vaccine. There have been no changes to the strain makeup since the beginning. So, you know, the whole way. So these are all designed to target the original, you know, the so-called Wuhan strain, the very first strain, which does not exist anymore anywhere in the world. Moderna and other companies have been working on updated versions of these messenger RNA based vaccines. There is the one that Moderna wants to roll out in the fall is a bivalent vaccine that would mix the original Omicron and a version of the vaccine. I'm sorry, let me start again. The original vaccine with a new version that is targeting the original Omicron. They don't have any data on that yet. It's in trials. They do have data on another version of the vaccine they were working on that specifically targeted the beta variant. They're not going to roll that out. But what was sort of important about the data there and what their study showed is that even though it targeted the beta variant, it actually appeared to induce more antibodies against the Omicron variant than the original vaccine, which suggests that, you know, updating it a bit, even if you're not updating it to the most the active variant, the variant that is actually most prevalent at the time when you're administering it, can be helpful. So that's what Moderna is doing. Now, what the FDA is doing is that they are going to have a meeting on June 28th at which they are going to say what they think the makeup of the fall booster should be. And they're basically planning on having a fall booster, it seems like. And you know, they had a meeting last month where they talked about preparing for this, and you know, they were talking about sort of how it works when the flu vaccine, you know, gets designed for the year. You'll have a meeting at some point. You'll decide which particular flu strains you're going to target that year, but you got to give enough lead time for the companies that make the flu vaccines to manufacture the appropriate flu vaccine. Now, the FDA meeting at which they're going to discuss what strain the fall COVID booster is going to target, you know, whether it be Omicron or BA2 or BA3 or whatever, is on June 28th. And they talked at earlier meetings, and people we'd spoken to who sit on these committees had said that you need to balance on the one hand, giving the companies enough time, and on the other hand, not making a selection too early, because as we've seen, this virus can change very, very quickly.
Right.
Anyway, what Bancel said to me yesterday is that if on June 28th, they say they want a strain that is not the original Omicron, they won't be able to get it ready in time. He said, you know, you can't tell me on June 28th that you want a BA2 specific fall vaccine. It's just not physically possible. The plasmids that we've already started ordering we just couldn't get enough in time to make it. It would take weeks or months to get the plasmids together. Those are sort of it's one of the key ingredient of the vaccine.
Yeah.
In order to do it. So I did ask the FDA about this, and they said they had spoken with experts and that they thought that the timing was okay. It's possible that the experts will say, on the FDA's advisory committee will say, you know, original Omicron plus, Wuhan strain, that sort of bivalent vaccine that Moderna is already working on. That's what makes sense. And then everybody will move forward with that. And that seems like Moderna does not believe they'll have any trouble getting that ready on time. They could also say, let's stick with the original vaccine. And Moderna said they could do that too. But it sounds like Moderna is saying, if you say, you know, we want a BA2 specific vaccine in very vast quantities for the fall, they won't be able to do that.
There are so many variables here. It's really hard to know how this is going to play out.
Well, it's a very hard question for the FDA, but it also it sort of leaves me a little bit puzzled. Why is, Bensel saying this now, and why did the FDA not make the meeting sooner? And what's that advisory committee meeting going to be like, where notionally they're making a selection, but actually they've been told already that they don't really have a choice. It's too late to make a choice.
It may be too soon to know what variant to make the vaccine for, and too late to make that vaccine.
Well, that's sort of the basic problem here. I mean, it raises this concern that maybe mRNA vaccines just actually aren't fast enough to keep up with the virus. And that it goes to this basic question, I think, like what actually is the point of boosters? Do we need boosters? Are we trying to prevent all infections? Is that even possible? Or are we just trying to prevent severe disease? And in this case, maybe we don't need boosters. Maybe we don't need super targeted boosters. Maybe we don't need mRNA-based boosters. So these are the big questions for the next, months and years.
You'll have a lot to cover, Josh. That's my takeaway. It's a fascinating time. So let's move on to pharma and biotech earnings. We're still in the heart of first quarter earnings season. A lot of companies you follow have reported already, keeping you pretty busy there. We'll start with Pfizer, which is kind of the bellwether of the group. What's the good news, or in this case, the disappointing news?
Well, the Pfizer earnings weren't bad. They beat earnings estimates. One notable point is that sales of the COVID antiviral Paxlovid did come in short of expectations. Revenue is $25.7 billion above the analyst expectation of $24 billion in total. But Paxlovid sales were $1.5 billion short of the $2 billion guidance. Although it's actually worth noting that maybe a day or two before earnings, Pfizer had announced rare disappointing data in a Paxlovid trial. Paxlovid is this drug that is this COVID antiviral that's turned in shockingly good data throughout its development program. They'd run a test of this drug as a prophylactic to prevent infection in people who were in households, standard risk people, I believe, who were in households with people who had gotten sick. And the results were not statistically significant, according to Pfizer. So that's pretty disappointing. Shares were up 2% earnings day, although they are. So it was generally well received despite those wrinkles.
Okay. And we should just note the stock is down about 16% year to date, and it yields about 3.3%.
Although it's down 3.3% today.
Oh, no.
Although that's kind of not as bad as the rest of the market.
Right, right. Well, the market's giving back what it gave us yesterday.
Exactly.
So having had more time to digest Mr. Powell's comments. So let's move on to Moderna. Before we do, I want to remind people that we will take questions at the end of the call. So type in your questions. Let us know what's on your mind. Moderna reported also recently. Tell us what the company said. What's happening there?
Yeah, so this was Wednesday, yesterday. Moderna beat estimates by a lot. Sales were $6.1 billion versus the estimate of $4.2 billion. I think it's worth asking how significant that is, just because they did not change the $22 billion that they said they have in signed advance purchase agreements for the year for their COVID vaccine. So it could be that the sort of pie is just being sliced differently in terms of the four quarters of the year. I did speak to Bensel, the CEO, about this. He kind of said it's both. On the one hand, sales were heavy in the first quarter, but he expects more sales in the second half of the year. And he notes that the U.S. has not made any purchases yet this year. So if the U.S. does choose to do a fall booster campaign, and they would notionally need to buy more doses. The alternative is that it goes onto the private market, which Moderna said they are preparing for. And that's a possibility if Congress does not allocate the funds.
So who would buy in that case?
It would work the same way that any vaccine is purchased. Whoever those buyers are, hospital systems, various payers, the normal commercial channels.
So Moderna's down really sharply this year, about 40% or so. What is that a reflection of?
And well, there's a couple things.
What are analysts saying about, you know, the future prospects? But let's take us back. Tell us what happened, and then we'll look ahead.
I mean, there's a couple of things going on here. One is that all of biotech is down, although large cap biotech like Moderna is down less than small and mid cap biotech. I think the other thing is that investors are taking a look at the COVID vaccine outlook and still wrestling with how long term this market's going to be and what it's going to look like in a year or two and whether all of the things I was talking about a moment ago with regard to the fall booster campaign. I mean, I think these are all calculations that investors are dealing with in terms of, you know, how widespread and long term boosting is really going to be. And I think we don't really know. You know, Moderna makes the case that they have lots of drugs in late stage development and lots of programs going on, and they certainly have plenty of cash to you know, do all sorts of things to move more products to their pipeline, to do business development. But I think the big question remains, what will the future of the booster landscape be?
We'll keep coming back to that, I'm sure. So let's move on, though, to AbbVie, which also reported last week. Tell us about AbbVie's numbers.
Yeah, their earnings were roughly in line. They cut their guidance, but that guidance cut seems to be related to certain accounting changes that happened. It's not really worth going into what they were, but a number of these firms made these changes and had to adjust guidance for that reason. You know, the big thing for AbbVie is that their main drug, the sort of tentpole drug, the drug that, you know, they spun out of Abbott nearly a decade ago in order to sell, Humira, is their exclusivity is expiring in the U.S. next year, and they're going to have biosimilar competition from a number of companies. And so that's going to take a big chunk over time out of Humira sales. Shares fell 6% on the day they put out their earnings, although the stock is up 12% this year, or at least was as of yesterday. I don't know what's going on right now.
Right. We should note that AbbVie yields almost 4%, which is pretty high for the pharma sector and a pretty attractive yield. So let's move on. It's like a hit parade of big pharma, Bristol Myers. What's the story there?
Yeah, the similar to AbbVie, slight beat, also had to cut guidance, but for that same accounting change reason. The bigger news there is that the day before their earnings, I think it was, they announced approval of a drug called mavacamten, which treats an inherited heart condition called obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And what's notable there is that Bristol bought that drug or got that drug as part of a $13 billion purchase 2 years ago of a company called MyoKardia. And so, you know, that's finally hitting the market. The company fell 2.5% on earnings, but it's up more than 20% this year.
Okay, so there are two more companies I want to talk about, Teva Pharmaceuticals and Merck. Teva had some news on the opioid settlement. Fill us in there.
So Teva is one of these many companies in the sector that is dealing with a lot of litigation related to their alleged role in the opioid crisis. Some companies like Cardinal Health, for example, and other drug distributors have made national or nationwide settlements that have handled or dealt with the vast majority of the litigation facing them. Teva has, although it reached a tentative settlement years ago, has not reached a nationwide settlement yet. And, you know, I've spoken to the CEO many times, and every time he, you know, says he has high hopes that a settlement will happen soon. He said it again when we spoke yesterday. He said he expects a nationwide settlement by the end of the year. But it does seem more likely now than before that it really is about to happen. There have been a number of one-off settlements with various states in the past month. I believe Rhode Island was one of them. And what we're seeing is that the mix of payments that Teva is doing initially as part of the proposed framework, it was largely they were going to be donating, you know, giving billions of dollars worth of drugs used to treat addiction drugs that they manufacture and a little bit of cash. They're now going to be offering in these more recent statewide settlements are offering a much higher proportion of cash and then a little bit of this drug. And it looks like that's what the settlement's going to end up being. You know, the problem here is they have something like $20 billion in debt. So all of these cash payments are happening over many years. But it does feel like we're reaching the end of this very complicated story of the opioid litigation.
Yeah, long, dark history, as it were. How about Merck? The company reported in late April.
Yeah, their revenues were up 50% from the same quarter the previous year, which that was greeted very warmly by the market. The stock went up 5% that day.
Was that all from organic growth, or was there an acquisition in there?
A lot of that. So there's two things. First of all, sales were the first quarter last year due to pandemic impacts. It was just a very weak quarter, so it was a good comp, as they say. The other thing is that they had $3 billion in sales of their COVID antiviral. So if you take out the COVID antiviral, it wasn't much. The increase was there, but it wasn't quite as big. I spoke with Merck's CFO that day, and she said something interesting. We talk a lot about how biotech stocks are down, 30% over the so far this year. But she was saying that in their conversations with biotech executives, it really hasn't changed the executives' thinking on the value of their companies. She said, I think the world lives in hope. And if you're sitting in a biotech, you're waiting to understand, is this permanent or is it temporary? And I thought that may go some way to explaining why we haven't seen more biotech M&A, because, biotech company valuations are down, and big pharma firms are sitting on a lot of cash, but there haven't been that many deals. And it seems as though one thing that might be happening here is that these biotech executives are banking on the valuation cuts they've seen being a temporary condition.
I think a lot of us are hoping that the cuts across the market will be temporary, but that's a good question. If you think you can get a lot more for your stock in a more normalized environment, you may be less eager to sell now. So speaking of biotech, tell us how bad things are out there. I know that stocks were down a lot at the beginning of the year.
Yeah. So we looked earlier this week at how biotech stocks had done in April. The XBI, the SPDR, S&P Biotech ETF, was down 18% in April. It's down 34% so far, or as of the end of April, it was down 34% so far in 2022, and 46% over the past 12 months, which is quite dramatic. We should say that the IBB, another biotech ETF that tracks larger biotech stocks, largely, or it's weighted more heavily towards the larger end of the sector, it's down 24% over the last 12 months. So not as bad. But certainly, small cap biotechs are it's not getting better yet.
Right. Seems that way. You were bullish on the sector in a story in March. So far, it hasn't worked out quite as you expected. But as Litchfield, the CFO at Merck, says, hope springs eternal. So we're very focused on the near term in the markets. But many people think the long term opportunities for the sector could be tremendous. What is your thinking now about this, Josh?
Yeah, well, the story you're referring to, which ran at the end of March, was making, I think, a long-term case. I think we'd said at the time that, the coming months would be choppy, but that over like a 2-year time frame, there's a lot of opportunity. Although I will say, at the end of March when I wrote that, the sector was down 47%. Since the peak on February 8th of 2021, it's now down 57%. So the logic hasn't changed, and we were making a long-term case, but still, the near-term situation is certainly not looking good. There was an interesting email note from Jared Holtz, who's a strategist, a healthcare equity strategist at Oppenheimer, who said that things that are, supposed to help biotech, M&A and positive trial results, just haven't been doing it. In the past month, he noted that Glaxo's deal to buy a company called Sierra Oncology for $2 billion didn't help the rest of the sector, nor did some other positive data that had come out. He actually suggested like a broader rebalancing of the ETF to get rid of the smaller stocks. It feels a little bit just like a little bit of
window dressing.
Yeah, I think what he's saying is that there are, because of the IPO boom, there are some very small companies that are out there, potentially low quality biotechs that
that's true. But if you look at the other biotech ETF, the IBB, you know, it's not doing so great either.
It's true. You know, there was another note from an analyst at Jefferies named Michael Yee, who is basically saying just to expect more chop until bigger catalysts arrive.
So someday these things will be irresistibly cheap. That they may be coming soon. Anyway, let's move on to Biogen. This is a company that cannot stay out of the news. It's had a lot of trouble with its Alzheimer's drug, Aduhelm. Where do things stand now?
So they made a big announcement on Tuesday. They're effectively ending the Aduhelm commercial program. The CEO, Michelle Vanastos, is going to leave. He'll stay until they find somebody new. And now everyone's left asking, now what? You know, they're emphasizing data that's coming in a couple of months on another Alzheimer's drug called lecanemab, and on a depression drug that they are partnered with Sage Therapeutics on, called zuranolone. But these are both relatively high risk prospects. You know, they're continuing with the phase 4 trial of Aduhelm. That won't read out for a number of years. The various cuts are going to save them $1 billion, but the underlying problems for Biogen remain. You know, all of their key drugs are facing competitive challenges for one reason or another. And I think a lot of analysts were left on Tuesday saying, okay, you're sort of wiping that away, but what are you going to do? What's next? I think clearly the new CEO will have a lot of work cut out for them.
Do you think the company could become a takeover candidate at some point?
Certainly possible. I think that, the lecanemab readout is coming in, I believe, the fall. And there is, I think analysts have written, a lot of, or some value for that readout is built into the stock price right now. You know, if it's negative, it would be, you know, what I think many would refer to as like a distressed large cap biotech. And in that case, it would certainly seem logical that someone might want it. At this point, you know, if you were to buy it now, you'd be taking a big gamble, I think, on the outcome of the lecanemab trial, which we wrote about in our feature last week.
I guess the question is, if that trial does not work out, what are you getting if you buy the company?
Yeah, you know, there's an R&D engine, there's biosimilar, you know, there's stuff in there, but and there are reasons why big pharma firms might want some of these drugs that are, you know, help with sort of near-term growth. But yeah, that's a little bit beyond me. So I'm not sure.
Okay. Something to look at for the future. So let's go to some listener questions. Destiny asks, is it time to invest in the healthcare sector? I think we've been asking ourselves that all day. And which is better, if you think so, healthcare services, healthcare equipment, and I'll add to that pharma and biotech too. There's so many different aspects to the market. What's the thinking on the street about this?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure I have a great take. I mean, I think right now everyone's just trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next few days. I mean, the market's tumbling at this moment. It's hard to think of buying into any into any sector. But you know, I'm not sure I have a great answer, sort of broken down by sector at this point.
Do you look much at the healthcare services and healthcare equipment sectors?
Not as much. We have okay. In the past, but you know, it's been, we've been so focused on COVID in the past couple of years that, that stuff has kind of fallen by the wayside.
Right. And it seems to have fallen by the wayside in part among patients too, in terms of, elective surgeries involving healthcare equipment.
Sure.
But let's move on to the next question. Lori asks about your thoughts. She mentioned a number of the stocks we talked about, but she also mentioned Johnson & Johnson, and we haven't talked about that today. What's going on at Johnson & Johnson?
One thing that, you know, think about with Johnson & Johnson is that they're preparing for a very dramatic transformation of the company. You know, Johnson & Johnson has three main business units, pharma, consumer health, and medical devices. Essentially, they now refer to it as MedTech. And they, in the next couple of years, are going to be spinning off the consumer health division, which is, I think, interesting and a big change for this company, which is really the last of the very large
multi-conglomerates.
Yeah, they reported earnings in the middle of April, that slightly beat Wall Street expectations at the time.
Okay, so before we go, I just want to ask you a question. What is coming up in terms of big conferences that investors ought to be watching for? There's a lot of big healthcare conferences throughout the year. Anything you've got your eye on?
There's a number of there's a big cancer conference in the early June, the American Society of Clinical Oncology.
The ASCO conference.
Yeah. So that'll be June 3rd. I think that's the next one that really, you know, deserves some attention.
And when you look out over the rest of the year, in addition to COVID and the whole discussion we had about boosters, what do you think the other big themes are that investors ought to be watching?
I mean, you know, we had this feature in the magazine last weekend about Alzheimer's. There's at least one, if not more, major Alzheimer's drug readouts coming in the next couple of months that will have, you know, a major impact on the relevant stocks, including Biogen and Eisai and Eli Lilly and Roche later in the year. So that's one. And I think, you know, the other big thing is just what's going to happen with the biotech sector, and is it going to come back, and what's it going to mean for, you know, for all of the various parts of the market that circle around it.
I think that's a big topic to watch. So, Josh, thanks. We'll pick up there when we meet again in a couple of weeks. Thanks for your comments today and your many insights. And thanks for our listeners for tuning in. Tomorrow on Barron's Live, we will ponder the question, is crypto at a turning point? Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are struggling as the Fed tightens monetary policies. That seems to be the theme of the day. Darren Fonda, the crypto and finance editor at Barron's, and Chris Kuiper, director of research at Fidelity Digital Assets, will discuss what's next for digital assets in a tougher market for tech. So please come back tomorrow, folks. Thank you so much for joining us today. Stay well and have a good day.